PhD program. I'm writing a dissertation, and so I spend a lot of time dealing with one particular topic. And so speaking here allows me to indulge my academically promiscuous eye and take some time with other ideas I find interesting. So the hope, of course, is that you will also find it interesting as you follow me down this rabbit hole. So we'll see. But anyway, here we go. Let's talk about eels. This is an eel. I like this. I was Googling images of eels, and I like this one because there's a drawing. First of all, I like the shape of it because it's like an infinity symbol, which I think will connect a little bit what we're talking about, but also because this eel's smiling. It's kind of nice. Yeah. A real eel picture is terrifying, so this one is much nicer. Okay. So it's likely that most of us don't spend a ton of time thinking about eels. I never really did. Perhaps we've never even seen one outside of a sushi roll, but we're likely aware of them. They're a common enough fish that we can conjure an image in our minds. And I'm sure at some point all of us have wondered about what the deal is with an electric eel, because, like, what kind of science fiction nightmare is an electric eel? A fish that can electrocute you? But anyway, interesting side note, electric eels, not actually eels, knife fish. So if you take nothing else home, that's one thing to know. Anyway, we're not going to talk about electric eels, though. What we're going to talk about is, and stay with me here, two breeds of eels known as the European and American river eels, or to use their scientific names, Aguilla aguilla and Aguilla rostrata. I promise that's it for the Latin today. So, now in North America, eels have only recently sort of come into fashion as something to eat, mostly because of the popularity of sushi. But interestingly, eels have a long history in other parts of the world, like Japan, for instance, but also in Europe, as an important food, and also a very interesting, perplexing mystery. One that, if you read the blurb, you'll know this, involves Aristotle, Julius Caesar, Leonardo da Vinci, Sigmund Freud, the unification efforts of early modern Italy, Carlsberg beer, and the Bermuda Triangle. So, I hope I have your interest. So, just to cite my sources a little bit, a lot of what I'm talking about is coming from this book. It's called The Truth About Animals by Lucy Cook. And I came across this book after listening to an episode all about eels on a podcast called Radiolab, which, if anyone you know it, it's sort of a science podcast most of the time, although this week it was all about square dancing, so it sort of goes all over the place. But this is where I'm sort of, this is what intrigued me and got me thinking about eels. So, the big mystery around eels has to do, even though they're everywhere, we don't actually know where they come from. And there have been a number of theories dating back thousands of years. For instance, Aristotle, this guy over here, had this theory about 2,400 years ago in his sort of almanac, that's the picture over there, the Animalium Historia. Sorry, that was more Latin. So, and Lucy Cook writes about it in here like this. When Aristotle came to writing about this slimy enigma in his pioneering animal almanac in the 4th century BC, he was forced to conclude that the eel proceeds neither from pear nor from egg, but was instead born of the earth's guts. That is, it spontaneously emerged from the mud. He thought the worm casts we see in wet sand were embryonic eels boiling out of the ground. He folded the origins of the eel into this theory of spontaneous generation, which he applied liberally to an eclectic collection of animals, from flies to frogs, whose proliferation seemed inexplicable. Now, I don't know about you, but spontaneous generation seems like sounds like the kind of term you come up with when you're just too lazy to figure out the truth. It's kind of like when Atticus asks me why the sky is blue, and I tell him it's because it's God's favorite color. Just kidding, I've never told them that. I like to imagine that, you know, Aristotle's editor was breathing down his neck when he's trying to get this book out, and he's just like, yeah, frogs, flies, eels, let's go with spontaneous generation. All right, done, print it. Maybe that's how it worked, I don't know. So Aristotle, though, it turns out, was not alone in his outlandish ideas. So I'm going to give you a rundown here of some eel theories. For a few hundred years later, in the 1st century, Pliny the Elder decided that eels reproduced by rubbing themselves against rocks. He thought the scrapings of the skin would come off, and then those would turn into little baby eels, which would swim away. Over the past 5 centuries or so, it has been believed that eels emerged from the gills of fish, from the morning dew, but only at certain times of the year. and from electrical disturbances, whatever that means. At one point, it was believed eels emerged from the thatching of a roof where the eggs would be incubated in the heat of the sun. There was no explanation for how the eggs got there or how the eels, which have been around for some 40 million years, were born before the invention of thatched roofs. But anyway, thatched roofs. Here's a fun one. It was believed that the illicit wives and bastard children of priests were saved from damnation, because you could be damned for being the bastard child of a priest, by taking the form of an eel. That's why we have eels. During the Enlightenment, it was proposed that eels were viviparous, which means that their eggs are fertilized inside the womb, kind of like human beings, rather than laid like other fish, which is why we've never found an eel egg. This was proven wrong because the scientist who made that discovery had mistaken parasitic worms in an eel's stomach for little baby eels in a uterus. The problem of parasites came up again when years later someone very loudly declared that he had conclusively proven that eels were in fact the outgrowth of beetle dung. So beetles would go to the bathroom, eels would grow out, again, parasites to blame. So this brings us to Italy, where eels have long been a favorite meal. In fact, Marcus Gavius Apicius, who's known for writing what's believed to be the first cookbook, claimed that during a feast celebrating the victories of Julius Caesar in the first century, they consumed some 6,000 eels during these feasts. Leonardo da Vinci liked eels so much that he decided to include them in his most famous painting of a dinner. I'm sure we all know this painting. And so he decided that eels were so good that the disciples were eating eels. So as you can see here, there's eels with some orange slices. This is how they were mostly consumed during the Renaissance, which is why he put it back into there. Now, I don't remember, I'm of Italian descent, I don't remember my nonna making eels very often during Sunday dinner, but I'll take this book claim that the Italians love eels. So much so that a group of scientists during the early modern period, so this is just after the Renaissance, they decided that the best way to unify Italy, which was a bunch of warring states at the time, was to put out a prize for discovering the elusive eel gonads, so sex organs. Despite the copious amounts of eel meat that Italians had been eating for some 2,000 years, no one had ever been able to find their genitals. So this group of scientists started offering rewards to any fisherman that could provide an eel with documentable, parts. A specimen was eventually provided, a female eel full of eggs. However, the celebrations were sort of short-lived when it was discovered that this fisherman had just stuffed a bunch of other fish eggs into the eel and then said, "Here you go." So this put a bit of a damper on the eel enthusiasm within the Italian scientific community, until about 50 years later, when a rather large specimen washed up on the shores of Comacchio, which is on the northern coast of Italy. The eel was examined by a scientist named Carlo Mondini, the University of Bologna, and he was finally able to find the eel's elusive ovaries. And Italy was united forever. Just kidding. There was this problem of Mussolini a few years later. Anyway, so this left the Italians feeling pretty good about themselves, except that there was still a problem because nobody had found the eel's male counterpart. And so this is where Sigmund Freud comes into the picture. Yes, that's Sigmund Freud. As a 19-year-old student, Freud's first summer job was at a zoological field in Trieste on Italy's Adriatic coast. Now, the only way to find an eel's genitals, apparently, in just case you're ever looking for them in the future, is to cut an eel open and just kind of look around. So that's exactly what Freud did, with hundreds of eels for 8 hours a day for an entire summer. This was his job. So I don't know about you, but I feel like we might be getting a clue into his sort of phallic-centric thinking about the world. But anyway, after the whole summer, he couldn't find anything, so he quit, went back to school, became Sigmund Freud. And so it was another two decades later, around the turn of the century, that yet another Italian, because they love their eels, Giovanni Battista Grassi, found a conclusive specimen of the elusive male eel off the coast of Sicily, and he was all ready to procreate. So they knew exactly that this was what they were looking for. But even with that discovery, the question still remained about how and where this procreation happened. Grassi, having found some very small eels, about 3 inches long, in the Strait of Messina, off the coast of Italy, proclaimed that that was the elusive breeding ground of the European river eel, because that was the smallest ones they'd ever found. But alas, he was proven wrong when in 1903, a Danish oceanographer named Johannes Schmidt discovered, quite by accident, the tiniest eels that anyone had ever found, about the size of a pin needle, so maybe that big. But he found them near the Faroe Islands, which is in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean, just near Norway. So as you can see, quite a ways away. This is my Google map in case you ever want to walk from Messina to the Faroe Islands. But of course, the eels would have had to swim around Spain and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, far away from anywhere that they should be. So this discovery began Schmidt's 20-year obsession to find the eel breeding grounds. Fortunately for him, he was married to the heiress of the Carlsberg Brewery, and so he had a steady flow of, let's call them, research grants, allowing him to continue this Ahab-like quest for 2 decades. His search eventually led him to one of the weirdest spots in the ocean, the Sargasso Sea. Now, the Sargasso is a unique, because unlike any other sea on the planet, it has no land border. It just exists in the middle of the ocean, right where you see it there. It's the result of an ocean gyre because it's sort of at the confluence of the Gulf Stream to the west, the North Atlantic Current to the north, the Canary Current to the east, and the North Equatorial Current to the south. And so these all kind of swirl together, and they make a patch of this in-ocean sea where the water is calmer, clearer, bluer, and saltier than any of the surrounding water. It's also deeper. And the mystery and the mysterious nature of the Sargasso Sea is bolstered by fans of sort of spooky stories and conspiracy theories, because the western edge lies right in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. So, and I promise that's the end of my PowerPoint special effects. I won't do that again. I just couldn't resist. So the nature of the ocean gyre also means that in recent years, the Sargasso Sea has become the site of the North American garbage patch, but we'll consider that man-made disaster a little bit later on. Let's go back to 1921. So Schmidt had been on this quest for almost 2 decades when he finally captured the smallest eel larvae that anyone had ever found. It was only 1/4 inch thick, so very, very tiny. And he found it in the southern bit of the Sargasso Sea. And just so we're clear on the timeline here, Aristotle first wrote about eels in the 4th century BC, and it took until 1921 to actually find a baby eel. So you can do the math on that. No matter how long it took, this discovery allowed Schmidt and the other scientists to work out a hypothesis finally about the life cycle of the European eel. And in some ways, it's almost as weird as those earlier theories. It looks a little bit like this. So the eels start as eggs somewhere deep in the Sargasso Sea, and then they hatch, and these larvae simply drift along the ocean currents all the way to Europe. This is just the European one. There's also a North American eel, same kind of idea, but they go to the North America. So they drift along these currents, arrive in sort of the estuaries and outer rivers of Europe and North Africa, at which point they're sort of this 5 centimeter long glass eel. And they find a place within these rivers to embed themselves into the riverbed, where they can kind of sneak out and grab food. And eels will eat anything they can get their mouths around. And they embed themselves in there so that they can grow into maturity. They stay there for 12 to 20 years at the bottom of these rivers, kind of peeking out, growing. And then once they're big enough, a mature silver eel looks like this. So 20 years later, they will come back out of the rivers, load up, because now they have to come downriver from back to the ocean. And so then they get into the Atlantic Ocean, and it can take up to 3 years for them to travel all the way back to the Sargasso Sea. Somehow they find their way back. and then once they're back there, they reach full maturity, which is when they finally have gonads. They have their sexual organs, which is why for so many years, nobody could figure out what the eels were because they couldn't get ones old enough. It's not like human beings where it's all sort of there, just dormant. They don't exist until they're in this final stage, which is very interesting. So anyway, they get back to the Sargasso Sea. They got to find a mate somewhere in this giant ocean. They got to, you know, do whatever they do. We don't know what they do. Nobody's ever seen it. And they lay some more eggs, which we've also never found. And then it all starts again, and they die somewhere in there. This can take somewhere around 60 years for an eel's life cycle. So that was all of those 2,400 years of research came up with that. But the interesting thing, again, is that despite how nice and science textbooky this looks, the reality is that this is just a hypothesis. It's science's best guess at what an eel's life looks like. Let's go back to Lucy here. She writes, nearly a century later, so a century after Schmidt, our understanding of the eel's life cycle is little more than expensive guesswork. Despite billions of dollars and the best of modern technology, no adult Aguilla has ever been tracked all the way back on its journey from the rivers of Europe to the Sargasso Sea. Nor has one ever been observed mating in the wild, and no eggs have ever been found. Part of the problem is the strange nature of the Sargasso itself. It's breathtakingly deep, over 4 miles deep in some spots where the where submarine chasms have formed in the continental shelf. It's thought that the European eel, an ancient species of over 40 million years old, started breeding in this deep sea trench when the continents of Europe and Africa were much closer, geographically speaking. As the continents drifted apart, the eel was forced to migrate farther and farther to return to the place of its birth. The chances of catching the eel in the act are hampered by the great depths and the dangerous swells. Not only does eel spawning season coincide with the annual cyclone season, so hurricane season, but the Sargasso is, as I said before, slap dab in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And this famous disaster zone where countless ships have been swallowed up is part of the eel's extraordinary story. That it is part of the eel's extraordinary story is enough to promote the superstitious belief that Poseidon himself is keeping the eel's sex life secret. So, a lot going on with these little guys. But in the end, the point is that the eel, despite its sort of ubiquity in the world, remains a mystery. The other tragedy mixed into this is that rampant overfishing of eels, climate change, pollution, hydro dams, a recent fashion trend involving eel skin cowboy boots, which was promoted by former President George W. Bush, has resulted in populations of eels plummeting, in some cases by up to 99%. Hence, the secret of the eel breeding grounds in the depths of the Sargasso Sea, which is now being overrun, as I said before, by plastic garbage, might forever remain a mystery if they go extinct, which is a very real possibility. Now, as pressing and depressing as that reality is, the dire state of our oceans is not really what I'd been planning to talk about. And so let's acknowledge that move forward and keep thinking about it another time. So rather, what struck me about the eels and the Sargasso Sea and this two millennia long documented search for their origins, as I was reading about it, I couldn't help but think about the nature of mystery, and particularly the mystery of this thing that we refer to as God. It struck me that the history of the sometimes scientific pursuit of the origin of the eel is not unlike the development of the church over the last 2,000 years. As it pursues some way to define, rationalize, categorize, institutionalize, and ultimately manipulate this unknowable thing that we call God. And that's the nature of religion. It's why it's a way to control what seems uncontrollable, whether that's a set of rituals meant to appease a volcano god, or long, spiritually based self-help books aimed at using biblical principles to help us ward off depression, lose weight, raise children, or make a lot of money. Institutionalized religion, for all of its high-minded talk about being a route to encountering the divine, whether through ritual, 10-step programs, or simplistic anthropomorphizing of God, is primarily concerned with trying to destroy the divine. That is because, as human beings, the biggest draw towards a mystery is our desire to kill that mystery and to make the unknown known. This is true whether your drug of choice is religion or science. They're both after the same end goal. And I don't consider this entirely a bad thing, by the way. I think it's great that there are scientists working to destroy the mystery of cancer, for instance. But when it comes to something like God, categorization can be a little bit more problematic. When we think about it, one of the major drives behind sort of small e evangelism is the hope that if an evangelist is really successful, everyone will believe the same idea. And if everyone believes the same idea, whether that's a version of God or that Bon Jovi is the greatest rock band of all time, it will somehow make it true, thus destroying the mystery by making something right by consensus. So, you know, the question, if God isn't real, why do so many people believe in him, is kind of the Christian equivalent of 100 million Bon Jovi fans can't be wrong. I'm not going to weigh into that debate ever. This was an actual album cover of theirs, by the way, just in case you're wondering how needy they were. Anyway, I'm going to pull that.
It was an Elvis Presley album.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I'm going to remove that because that's way too much gold lame for anyone's eyes. Okay, at the end of the day, this is sort of a meaningless pursuit because there's no way to conclusively prove that God does or does not exist. And within that, there is no way to argue that any iteration of God, who may or may not exist, is better or worse than any other iteration. Essentially, we're chasing eels across the ocean when we try to define God, because God, whatever God is beyond our understanding. And so, whenever we try to define a thing that is beyond us, we usually end up just talking about ourselves or our experiences. Rob Bell, who I'm sure a lot of you have read or listened to his podcasts or seen his other things, talks about this idea in his book, which is called What We Talk About When We Talk About God. And he talks about it right on the first page. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this just to sort of think about this idea. So he writes, from people risking their lives to serve the poor because they believe God called them to do it, to pastors claiming that the latest tornado or hurricane or earthquake is God's judgment, to professors proclaiming that God has only ever been a figment of our imagination, to people in a recovery meeting sitting in a circle drinking bad coffee and talking about surrendering to a higher power, to musicians in their acceptance speech at an awards show thanking God for their hit song about a late night booty call, whatever, when it comes to God, we are all over the place. Like a mirror, God appears to be more and more a reflection of whoever it is that happens to be talking about God at the moment. The truth is, we have a problem with God. It's not a problem of definition. what it is we're talking about when we talk about God. And it's not just the increasing likelihood that two people discussing God are in fact talking about two extraordinarily different realities while using the same word. The problem with God goes much, much deeper. Now, he sort of goes in one direction with that. I'm not entirely in agreement with him, and since I'm here and he's not, we're going to go with my decision about what the problem is. For me, when I think about this, and I think about human relationships that I have, people that I talk with, the deeper problem is that we don't recognize the act of construction that is going on when we conceptualize God. Now, in Genesis, it says that we are all made in God's image. And while the poetic truth of that is beautiful, the reality is as well that God, when we try to define God's isness, is very much made in our image. We might say, but our image of God is based on the Bible, and that's great. But the image of God in the Bible is also someone else's construction based on their experiences and impressions. It was written at a time and place that is very different from our own, for an audience that certainly did not include people in the 21st century who live in a country, speak a language, and read their words through technology that wouldn't exist for well over 1,000 years after the authors were dead and buried. Then those words were edited and curated by another group of people with their own notions of God from another time and place. Those changes were changed yet again by translators with their own interests and biases and political motivations. If you ever want to know about that, check out the history of the King James Bible. Of course, after all of those large-scale changes, we have to accept that our own ideas are based on what pastors and other teachers have taught us throughout our lives about how to think about this edited and translated construction version of God. Also, we can't forget about the influence of the relationships with our own parents, good or bad. After all, it's pretty hard to conceive of something like God the Father without at least a little bit of, you know, Todd or Jeff, or in my case, Clifford, the father, seeping into our image of God. And this is not, by the way, an attack on the idea of the existence of God. This is just how our human brains work. Everything we perceive is a constructed version of the thing we are perceiving. Jane and I have been married for almost 10 years. We know each other better than almost anyone else, I think. And and yet, the Jane that lives in my brain remains a constructed image based on the way that the sort of synapses in my brain have processed my experience of her and the way that I've projected my own preferences onto her. It's for this reason that even after, you know, 10 years, she will still occasionally do or say something that makes me go, wait, what? But, you know, for better or worse, right? And for the record, I'm sure she says, wait, what, far more often than I do. So, all of this is to say that when we're trying to describe a mystery, we are attempting to make rational something that is inherently resistant to rationality. And by that, that doesn't mean that God or believing in God is irrational, but rather it's something we could call transrational. Now, that's a loaded term. It's a little bit complicated. It comes from a guy named Joseph Campbell, who was a literature professor in the mid-20th century in the United States. And I'm going to unpack that with a little help from a guy named Pete Holmes, because Campbell, for all of his brilliant ideas, is kind of impenetrable. So rather than spending the next hour or so trying to break it down, I'm going to go with Pete Holmes' version, which is more succinct and much funnier than I could be. So this is, he just put this book out. It's not a great book, I'll be honest. I was a little disappointed, called Comedy, Sex, God. You could put the commas in there if you want, or you could not. But anyway, he sort of breaks down his own journey. The first half is really interesting. The second half, I felt like he was trying to convert me to something the whole time. But if you're interested, he's a podcaster, comedian, actor, interesting guy. So anyway, he's talking about his own sort of journey from in his understanding of God. Growing up, my God was the Burger King King. I mean, of course it was the God of the Bible, but whenever I pictured him, I imagined the Burger King King. We know who the Burger King King is, right? The kind of creepy, okay, I should have put a picture up. I would imagine the Burger King King sitting up on a cloud and listening to me and nodding his crowned head, a Whopper Jr. within easy reach, his face frozen in that creepy, unmoving, permanent smile, Jesus rollerblading in the background. Sorry, and there's no kids in here. Okay, it's a little bit crude, okay? So just a fair warning. Not too bad, but anyway. When I stopped believing in God, the Burger King King was the God I stopped believing in. It was pretty easy to let go of. Too many of my friends could dismantle my faith by simply asking, "You believe there's an old man in the sky watching you masturbate?" For most of my life, I had to reply, "Yes, God's kinky like that?" And then came Joseph Campbell, who introduced me, didn't introduce him personally, but to the idea that the image of God, the image I had for God and the God itself were not the same thing. Metaphors, Campbell teaches, are used to tell stories about things that are hard to touch with our intellect, experiences like God. My Burger King King was both right and wrong. Joseph Campbell was the first person I found who could explain to me that the image I chose wasn't supposed to be taken literally. That wasn't the point. It was an idea that pointed to a truth that was hard, maybe impossible, to put into words. Campbell wasn't just saying we use metaphors to talk about God. Campbell was saying that God itself is a metaphor. His definition of God wasn't about knowing. His definition of God was about coming to terms with our perpetual unknowing. Campbell puts it like this: God is a metaphor for a mystery that absolutely transcends all categories of human thought, including being and non-being. Instead of something you know, and something you know, and something you know correctly so that you are in and others are out, Campbell was saying that there is one more sort of Russian nesting doll inside the God doll, a mystery. You can't even picture it. No image would suffice. Some things are just too immense to trap with language. Barry Taylor, stay with me here, the road manager for AC/DC, put it this way: God is the name of the blanket we throw over the mystery to give it shape. come on, shouldn't I have learned that in church? Why am I hearing this from the road manager of AC/DC? It's a good question. God had never been a mystery to me. The whole point of God was something to hold on to. God was something to calm the masses, to help us stop asking questions, to tick boxes so that we can move on with our lives and think about other things. But now I was starting to look at the big questions from a different vantage point entirely. Suddenly, it didn't matter if we called the speck of mass that erupted into the Big Bang, the singularity, or if we called it God. When we concede that it's a mystery, what's the difference? We're all trying to put language to something we can't speak about, something we can't fully know. Science is trying to photograph it. The mystic is trying to feel it. And are we really going to keep fighting about vocabulary? I had been told that God works in mysterious ways. But now I saw that the mystery works in godly ways, you know, spontaneously creating itself and all. And a metaphor was as close as we could get to understanding that. These things weren't meant to be labeled and sorted easily in our minds. The word Joseph Campbell uses for this type of thinking is transrational. It's not irrational. It's beyond rationality. It's not blueprints to build a bridge. It's crying at a song that doesn't have any words. We are like dogs trying to understand the internet. And the best way we can touch the unfathomable mystery is with a myth. So now it's important to think about that word myth for a moment, because oftentimes myth is conflated with fiction and taken to be understood as just being untrue. So in that sense, to say God is a myth would be to say that there is no God. And that's not what I'm saying here. Rather, a myth, in the sort of Joseph Campbell sense, is an idea that is so big that it transcends the categories of true and untrue. So holding on to our perception of God and believing that that perception is the end of the line means that we come to a stop rather than moving beyond and getting a glimpse of the infinite that our God myth is pointing us towards. So religion has always been a way to shut down that urge to peek behind the curtain of God, or behind the curtain of the God myth. Depending on what religion or version of religion you belong to, you will likely encounter this thing called dogma, which are attempts at defining and therefore limiting the infinite expanse of the thing for which we use the word God. Let's think about those eels for a moment. Throughout the development of the theory that we just looked at, there were dissenting voices. Whenever a new theory came up about these origins of these slippery fish, people would say, no, we've got it. And the new theories had to be proven, even as they were mocked. And this is sort of the nature of the scientific method. Imagine if all learning had stopped with Aristotle, right? And it was just spontaneous generation. It doesn't really feel good. That answer didn't work for eels. It doesn't work for science, and it shouldn't work for God. Whenever we lock into an idea, we lock out and are thus locked out from a more robust and possibly more fulfilling picture of who God is. So when we regard God as a fixed thing, one that we are right about and that everyone else is wrong, we are not only being foolish, but we're missing out on an experience of the divine through each other. The reality is that no two people have the same idea of God, who God is. Even in the most sort of fundamental, Bible-believing, theologically conservative church, if you were to ask each person to describe their image of God, you would get as many versions of God as there were people that you asked. And that is a beautiful thing. Because being made in the image of God also means that we make the image of God. Each of us are little bits of that divine walking around. And I know that sounds a little new age, hippy-dippy, whatever, but it's right there in the Bible. God, it seems to me, intended us to be God to one another. Think of Jesus telling us to go out and do likewise. That's what he did, to be the salt of the earth, to be the city on the hill. It's all there. We're not just supposed to sit back and admire God for being good or admire what Jesus did. We're supposed to be that goodness to others. And I know this isn't easy. Discord is a difficult thing, and not everyone we encounter is not only ready to acknowledge the existence of their biased perceptions, but also be free of them. And although politics and centuries of tribalism between warring groups that just happen to use a different name for whatever it is that we use the word God for make peace and community quickly seem utterly impossible, it's important to remember that finding out where eels have sex also continues to be seem impossible. But that mystery drives people to work harder and to dig deeper to find the truth. God is a metaphor for the mystery that absolutely transcends all categories of human thought, including being and non-being. So whether you call that thing God, Creator, Yahweh, Allah, Buddha, Jesus, Mary, or Carl, there's always room for us to learn from each other, to grow in our understanding, to be blessed by each other's presence, and to stop letting something as silly as vocabulary get in the way of loving each other. Nobody really knows anything, so we might as well not fight about what we don't know. This doesn't mean that we have to start believing everything or anything that other people believe. It also doesn't mean we need to let go of the things that we believe, the metaphor that comforts us. But it does mean that we need to leave a little room for this thing called cognitive dissonance. And that's the discomfort that one feels from maintaining two or more contradictory beliefs at the same time. After all, if we're being honest with ourselves, God, even the God in one sacred text like the Bible, is essentially the definition of cognitive dissonance. And if we can pull this off, maybe, just maybe, one day we might be able to grasp, at least for a moment, this slippery fish that is everything and nothing, absolute and conditional, beautiful and ugly, pleasure and pain, minuscule and enormous, hope and despair. The I am. Not the I am for this group and against that one, just I am. Full stop. It's not God is, fill in the blank. It's just God is. In any way that we can be close, that we can be near or in that isness is valid, because it's all a mystery. And mysteries don't exclude. They envelop. Thanks.